Chapter 4. We have to go up on wiring fatigue. The motor lorries roll up after dark. We climb in. It is a warm evening, and the twilight seems like a canopy, under whose shelter we feel drawn together. Even the stingy Chiatin gives me a cigarette and then a light. We stand jammed in together, shoulder to shoulder. There is no room to sit. But we do not expect that. Müller is in a good mood for once. He is wearing his new boots. The engines drone. The lorries bump and rattle. The roads are worn and full of holes. We dare not show a light, so we lurch along and are often almost pitched out. That does not worry us, however. It can happen if it likes. A broken arm is better than a hole in the guts, and many a man would be thankful enough for such a chance of finding his way home again. Beside us stream the munition columns and long files. They are making the pace. They overtake us continually. We joke with them, and they answer back. A wall becomes visible. It belongs to a house which lies on the side of the road. I suddenly prick up my ears. Am I deceived? Again I hear distinctly the cackle of geese. A glance at Kaczynski, a glance from him to me, we understand one another. Cat, I hear some aspirins for the frying pan over there. He nods. It will be attended to when we come back. I have their number. Of course, Cat has their number. He knows all about every leg of goose within a radius of 15 miles. The lorries arrive at the artillery lines. The gun emplacements are camouflaged with bushes against aerial observation and look like a kind of military feast of the tabernacles. These branches might seem gay and cheerful were not cannon embowered there. The air becomes acrid with the smoke of the guns and the fog. The fumes of powder taste bitter on the tongue. The roar of the guns makes our lorries stagger. The reverberation rolls, raging away to the rear. Everything quakes. Our faces change imperceptibly. We are not, indeed, in the front line, but only in the reserves. Yet in every face can be read, "This is the front. Now we are within its embrace." It is not fear. Men who have been up as often as we have become thick-skinned. Only the young recruits are agitated. Cat explains to them, "That was a 12-inch. You can tell by the report. Now you'll hear the burst." But the muffled thud of the burst does not reach us. It is swallowed up in the general murmur of the front. Cat listens. "There'll be a bombardment tonight." We all listen. The front is restless. "The Tommies are firing already," says Krupp. The shelling can be heard distinctly. It is the English batteries to the right of our section. They are beginning an hour too soon. According to us, they start punctually at 10 o'clock.
"What's got them?"
says Müller. "Their clocks must be fast."
"There'll be a bombardment, I tell you. I can feel it in my bones."
Cat shrugs his shoulders. Three guns open fire close beside us. The burst of flame shoots across the fog. The guns roar and boom. We shiver and are glad to think that we shall be back in the huts early in the morning. Our faces are neither paler nor more flushed than usual. They are not more tense nor more flabby, and yet they are changed. We feel that in our blood a contact has shot home. That is no figure of speech, it is fact. It is the front, the consciousness of the front, that makes this contact. The moment that the first shells whistle over and the air is rent with the explosions, there is suddenly in our veins, in our hands, in our eyes, a tense waiting, a watching, a heightening alertness, a strange sharpening of the senses. The body with one bound is in full readiness. It often seems to me as though it were the vibrating, shuddering air that with a noiseless leap springs upon us, or as though the front itself emitted an electric current which awakened unknown nerve centers. Every time it is the same. We start out for the front plain soldiers, either cheerful or gloomy. Then come the first gun emplacements, and every word of our speech has a new ring. When Cat stands in front of the hut and says there'll be a bombardment, that is merely his own opinion. But if he says it here, then the sentence has the sharpness of a bayonet in the moonlight. It cuts clean through the thought. It thrusts nearer and speaks to this unknown thing that has awakened in us, a dark meaning. There'll be a bombardment. Perhaps it is our inner and most secret life that shivers and falls on guard. To me, the front is a mysterious whirlpool. Though I am in still water, far away from its center, I feel the whirl of the vortex sucking me slowly, irresistibly, inescapably into itself. From the earth, from the air, sustaining forces pour into us, mostly from the earth. To no man does the earth mean so much as to the soldier. When he presses himself down upon her long and powerfully, when he buries his face and his limbs deep in her from the fear of death by shellfire, then she is his only friend, his brother, his mother. He stifles his terror and his cries in her silence and her security. She shelters him and releases him for 10 seconds to live, to run, 10 seconds of life, receives him again, and often forever. Earth, earth, earth. Earth with thy folds and hollows and holes, into which a man may fling himself and crouch down. In the spasm of terror, under the hailing of annihilation, in the bellowing death of the explosions, O Earth, thou grantest us the great resisting surge of new-won life. Our being, almost utterly carried away by the fury of the storm, streams back through our hands from thee. And we, thy redeemed ones, bury ourselves in thee, and through the long minutes in a mute agony of hope, bite into thee with our lips. At the sound of the first droning of the shells, we rush back in one part of our being 1,000 years. By the animal instinct that is awakened in us, we are led and protected. It is not conscious. It is far quicker, much more sure, less fallible than consciousness. One cannot explain it. A man is walking along without thought or heed. Suddenly he throws himself down on the ground, and a storm of fragments flies harmlessly over him. Yet he cannot remember either to have heard the shell coming or to have thought of flinging himself down. But had he not abandoned himself to the impulse, he would now be a heap of mangled flesh. It is this other, this second sight in us, that has thrown us to the ground and saved us without our knowing how. If it were not so, there would not be one man alive from Flanders to the Vosges. We march up, moody or good-tempered soldiers. We reach the zone where the front begins and become on the instant human animals. An indigent-looking wood receives us. We pass by the soup kitchens. Under cover of the wood, we climb out. The lorries turn back. They are to collect us again in the morning before dawn. Mist and the smoke of guns lie breast high over the fields. The moon is shining. Along the road, troops file. Their helmets gleam softly in the moonlight. The heads and the rifles stand out above the white mist, nodding heads, rocking barrels. Farther on, the mist ends. Here the heads become figures. Coats, trousers, and boots appear out of the mist, as from a milky pool. They become a column. The column marches on, straight ahead. The figures resolve themselves into a block. Individuals are no longer recognizable. The dark wedge presses onward, fantastically topped by the heads and the weapons floating on the milky pool. A column. Not men at all. Guns and munition wagons are moving along a crossroad. The backs of the horses shine in the moonlight. Their movements are beautiful. They toss their heads and their eyes gleam. The guns and the wagons float past the dim background of the moonlit landscape. The riders in their steel helmets resemble knights of a forgotten time. It is strangely beautiful and arresting. We push on to the pioneer dump. Some of us load our shoulders with pointed and twisted iron stakes. Others thrust smooth iron rods through rolls of wire and go off with them. The burdens are awkward and heavy. The ground becomes more broken. From ahead come warnings. Look out, deep shell hole on the left. Mind, trenches. Our eyes peer out. Our feet and our sticks feel in front of us before they take the weight of the body. Suddenly the line halts. I bump my face against the roll of wire carried by the man in front and curse. There are some shell-smashed lorries in the road. Another order. Cigarettes and pipes out. We are near the line. In the meantime, it has become pitch dark. We skirt a small wood and then have the front line immediately before us. An uncertain red glow spreads along the skyline from one end to the other. It is in perpetual movement, punctuated with the bursts of flame from the nozzles of the batteries. Balls of light rise up high above it, silver and red spheres which explode and rain down in showers of red, white, and green stars. French rockets go up, which unfold a silk parachute to the air and drift slowly down. They light up everything as bright as day. Their light shines on us, and we see our shadows sharply outlined on the ground. They hover for the space of a minute before they burn out. Immediately fresh ones shoot up in the sky, and again green, red, and blue stars. "Bombardment," says Cat. The thunder of the guns swells to a single heavy roar, and then breaks up again into separate explosions. The dried bursts of the machine guns rattle. Above us the air teems with invisible swift movement, with howls, pipings, and hisses. They are smaller shells, and amongst them, booming through the night like an organ, go the great coal boxes and the heavies. They have a hoarse, distant bellow like a rutting stag, and make their way high above the howl and whistle of the smaller shells. It reminds me of flocks of wild geese when I hear them. Last autumn the wild geese flew day after day across the path of the shells. The searchlights begin to sweep the dark sky. They slide along it like gigantic tapering rulers. One of them pauses and quivers a little. Immediately a second is beside him. A black insect is caught between them and tries to escape. The airman. He hesitates, is blinded, and falls. At regular intervals we ram in the iron stakes. Two men hold a roll and the others spool off the barbed wire. It is that awful stuff with close-set long spikes. I am not used to unrolling it and tear my hand. After a few hours it is done, but there is still some time before the lorries come. Most of us lie down and sleep. I try also, but it has turned too chilly. We know we are not far from the sea because we are constantly waked by the cold. Once I fall fast asleep. Then wakening suddenly with a start, I do not know where I am. I see the stars, I see the rockets, and for a moment have the impression that I have fallen asleep at a garden fete. I don't know whether it is morning or evening. I lie in the pale cradle of the twilight and listen for soft words which will come, soft and near. Am I crying? I put my hand to my eyes. It is so fantastic. Am I a child? Smooth skin. It lasts only a second. Then I recognize the silhouette of Kaczynski, the old veteran. He sits quietly and smokes his pipe, a covered pipe, of course. When he sees I am awake, he says, "That gave you a fright. There was only a nose cap. It landed in the bushes over there." I sit up. I feel myself strangely alone. It's good Cat is there. He gazes thoughtfully at the front and says, "Mighty fine fireworks if they weren't so dangerous." One lands behind us. Some recruits jump up, terrified. A couple of minutes later, another comes over, nearer this time. Cat knocks out his pipe. "We're in for it." Then it begins in earnest. We crawl away as well as we can in our haste. The next lands fair amongst us. Two fellows cry out. Green rockets shoot up on the skyline. Barrage. The mud flies high, fragments whiz past. The crack of the guns is heard long after the roar of the explosions. Beside us lies a fair-headed recruit in utter terror. He has buried his face in his hands. His helmet has fallen off. I fish hold of it and try to put it back on his head. He looks up, pushes the helmet off, and like a child creeps under my arm, his head close to my breast. The little shoulders heave. Shoulders just like Kemmerich's. I let him be. So that the helmet should be of some use, I stick it on his behind. Not for a jest, but out of consideration, since that is his highest part. And though there is plenty of meat there, a shot in it can be damned painful. Besides, a man has to lie for months on his belly in the hospital, and afterwards he would be almost sure to have a limp. It's got someone pretty badly. Cries are heard between the explosions. At last it grows quiet. The fire is lifted over us and is now dropping on the reserves. We risk a look. Red rockets shoot up to the sky. Apparently there's an attack coming. Where we are, it is still quiet. I sit up and shake the recruit by the shoulder. All over, kid. It's all right this time. He looks round him, dazedly. You'll get used to it soon, I tell him. He sees his helmet and puts it on. Gradually he comes to. Then suddenly he turns fiery red and looks confused. Cautiously he reaches his hand to his behind and looks at me dismally. I understand at once. Gun-shy. That wasn't the reason I had stuck his helmet over it. That's no disgrace, I reassure him. And he's the man before you who's had his pants full after the first bombardment. Go behind that bush there and throw your underpants away. Get along. He goes off. Things become quieter, but the cries do not cease. What's up, Albert? I ask. A couple of columns over there got it in the neck. The cries continued. It is not men. They could not cry so terribly. Wounded horses, says Cat. It's unendurable. It is the moaning of the world. It is the martyred creation, wild with anguish, filled with terror and groaning. We are pale. Dittering stands up. God! For God's sake, shoot them! He is a farmer and very fond of horses. It gets under his skin. Then, as if deliberately, the fire dies down again. The screaming of the beasts becomes louder. One can no longer distinguish whence in this now quiet, silvery landscape it comes. Ghostly, invisible, it is everywhere. Between heaven and earth it rolls on immeasurably. Dettering raves and yells out, "Shoot them! Shoot them, can't you? Damn you again!" They must look after the men first, says Cat quietly. We stand up and try to see where it is. If we could only see the animals, we should be able to endure it better. Müller has a pair of glasses. We see a dark group, bearers with stretchers, and larger black clumps moving about. Those are the wounded horses. But not all of them. Some gallop away in the distance, fall down, and then run on farther. The belly of one is ripped open. The guts trail out. He becomes tangled in them and falls. Then he stands up again. Dettering raises up his gun and aims. Cat hits it in the air. Are you mad? Dettering trembles and throws his rifle on the ground. We sit down and hold our ears. But this appalling noise, those groans and screams, penetrate. They penetrate everywhere. We can bear almost anything, but now the sweat breaks out on us. We must get up and run, no matter where, but where these cries can no longer be heard. And it is not men, only horses. From the dark group, stretchers move off again. Then single shots crack out. The black heap convulses and then sinks down. At last. But still it is not the end. The men cannot overtake the wounded beasts which fly in their pain, their wide-open mouths full of anguish. One of the men goes down on one knee. A shot. One horse drops. Another. The last one props itself on its forelegs and drags itself round in a circle like a merry-go-round, squatting. It drags round in circles on its stiffened forelegs. Apparently its back is broken. The soldier runs up and shoots it. Slowly. Humbly it sinks to the ground. We take our hands from our ears. The cries are silenced. Only a long-drawn, dying sigh still hangs on the air. Then only again the rockets, the singing of the shells, and the stars there. Most strange. Dettering walks up and down, cursing. Like to know what harm they've done. He returns to it once again. His voice is agitated. It sounds almost dignified as he says, I tell you, it is the vilest baseness to use horses in the war. We go back. It is time we return to the lorries. The sky has become brighter. 3 o'clock in the morning. The breeze is fresh and cool. A pale hour makes our faces look gray. We trudge onward in single file through the trenches and shell holes and come again to the zone of mist. Kaczynski is restive. That's a bad sign. What's up, Kat? Says Krupp. I wish I were back home. Home, he means the huts. We'll soon be out of it, Kat. He is nervous. I don't know. We come to the communication trench and then to the open fields. The little wood reappears. We know every foot of ground here. That's the cemetery with the mounds and the black crosses. That moment it breaks out behind us, swells, roars, and thunders. We duck down. A cloud of flame shoots up 100 yards ahead of us. The next minute, under a second explosion, part of the wood rises slowly in the air. 3 or 4 trees sail up and then crash to pieces. The shells begin to hiss like safety valves. Heavy fire. Take cover, yells somebody. Cover! The fields are flat. The wood is too distant and dangerous. The only cover is the graveyard and the mounds. We stumble across in the dark, and as though he had been spat there, every man lies glued behind a mound. Not a moment too soon. The dark goes mad. It heaves and raves. Darknesses blacker than the night rush on us with giant strides, over us and away. The flames of the explosions light up the graveyard. There is no escape anywhere. By the light of the shells I try to get a view of the fields. They are surging sea. Daggers of flame from the explosions leap up like fountains. It is impossible for anyone to break through it. The wood vanishes. It is pounded, crushed, torn to pieces. We must stay here in the graveyard. The earth bursts before us. It rains clods. I feel a smack. My sleeve is torn away by a splinter. I shut my fist. No pain. Still, that does not reassure me. Wounds don't hurt till afterwards. I feel the arm all over. It is grazed but sound. Now a crack on the skull. I begin to lose consciousness. Like lightning, the thought comes to me, don't faint. I sink down in the black broth and immediately come up to the top again. A splinter slashes into my helmet, but has already traveled so far that it does not go through. I wipe the mud out of my eyes. A hole is torn up in front of me. Shells hardly ever land in the same hole twice. I'll get into it. With one lunge, I shoot as flat as a fish over the ground. There it whistles again. Quickly, I crouch together, claw for cover. Feel something on the left. Shove in beside it. It gives way. I groan. The earth leaps. The blast thunders in my ears. I creep under the yielding thing. Cover myself with it. Draw it over me. It is wood, cloth. Cover, cover, miserable cover against the whizzing splinters. I open my eyes. My fingers grasp a sleeve. An arm. A wounded man? I yell to him. No answer. A dead man. My hand gropes farther. Splinters of wood. Now I remember again that we are lying in the graveyard. But the shelling is stronger than everything. It wipes out the sensibilities. I merely crawl still farther under the coffin. It shall protect me, though death himself lies in it. Before me gapes the shell hole. I grasp it with my eyes as with fists. With one leap I must be in it. There I get a smack in the face. A hand clamps onto my shoulder. Has the dead man waked up? The hand shakes me. I turn my head. In the second of light I stare into the face of Kaczynski. He has his mouth wide open and is yelling. I hear nothing. He rattles me, comes nearer. In a momentary lull his voice reaches me. Gas! 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 Pass it on! I grab for my gas mask. Some distance from me there lies someone. I think of nothing but this. That fellow there must know. Gas! Gas! I call. I lean toward him. I swipe at him with the satchel. He doesn't see. Once again. Again. He merely ducks. It's a recruit. I look at Cat desperately. He has his mask on. I pull out mine, too. My helmet falls to one side. It slips over my face. I reach the man. His satchel is on the side nearest me. I seize the mask, pull it over his head. He understands. I let go and with a jump drop into the shell hole. The dull thud of the gas shells mingles with the crashes of the light explosives. A bell sounds between the explosions, gongs and metal clappers warning everyone. Gas! 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 Someone plumps down behind me. Another. I wipe the goggles of my mask clear of the moist breath. It is Cat, Krop, and someone else. All four of us lie there in heavy, watchful suspense and breathe as lightly as possible. These first minutes with the mask decide between life and death. Is it airtight? I remember the awful sights in the hospital, the gas patients, who in day-long suffocation cough up their burnt lungs and clots. Cautiously, the mouth applied to the valve, I breathe. The gas still creeps over the ground and sinks into all hollows. Like a big, soft jellyfish, it floats into our shell hole and lolls there obscenely. I nudge Cat. It is better to crawl out and lie on top than to stay where the gas collects most. But we don't get as far as that. A second bombardment begins. It is no longer as though shells roared. It is the earth itself raging. With a crash, something black bears down on us. It lands close beside us, a coffin thrown up. I see Cat move, and I crawl across. The coffin has hit the fourth man in our hole on his outstretched arm. He tries to tear off his gas mask with the other hand. Krop seizes him just in time, twists the hand sharply behind his back and holds it fast. Cat and I proceed to free the wounded arm. The coffin lid is loose and bursts open. We are easily able to pull it off. We toss the corpse out. It slides down to the bottom of the shell hole, and we try to loosen the under part. Fortunately, the man swoons, and Krop is able to help us. We no longer have to be careful, but work away till the coffin gives with a sigh before the spade that we have dug in under it. It has grown lighter. Cat takes a piece of the lid, places it under the shattered arm, and we wrap all our bandages round it. For the moment we can do no more. Inside the gas mask my head booms and roars. It is nigh bursting. My lungs are tight. They breathe always the same hot, used-up air. The veins on my temples are swollen. I feel I am suffocating. A gray light filters through to us. I climb out over the edge of the shell hole. In the dirty twilight lies a leg torn clean off. The boot is quite whole. I take that all in at a glance. Now something stands up a few yards distant. I polish the windows. In my excitement they are immediately dimmed again. I peer through them. The man there no longer wears his mask. I wait some seconds. He has not collapsed. He looks around and makes a few paces. Rattling in my throat, I tear my mask off too and fall down. The air streams into me like cold water. My eyes are bursting. The wave sweeps over me and extinguishes me. The shelling has ceased. I turn towards the crater and beckoning to the others. They take off their masks. We lift up the wounded man, one taking his splinted arm, and so we stumble off hastily. The graveyard is a mass of wreckage. Coffins and corpses lie strewn about. They have been killed once again, but each of them that was flung up saved one of us. The hedge is destroyed. The rails of the light railway are torn up and rise stiffly in the air in great arches. Someone lies in front of us. We stop. Krop goes on alone with the wounded man. The man on the ground is a recruit. His hip is covered with blood. He is so exhausted that I feel for my water bottle where I have rum and tea. Cat restrains my hand and stoops over him.
Where's it got you, comrade?
His eyes move. He is too weak to answer. We slit open his trousers carefully. He groans.
Gently, gently. It is much better.
If he's been hit in the stomach, he oughtn't to drink anything. There's no vomiting. That's a good sign. We lay the hip bare. It is one mass of mincemeat and bone splinters. The joint has been hit. This lad won't walk anymore. I wet his temples with a moistened finger and give him a swig. His eyes move again. We see now that the right arm is bleeding as well. Cat spreads out two wads of dressing as wide as possible so that they will cover the wound. I look for something to bind loosely round it. We have nothing more, so I slip up the wounded man's trouser leg still farther in order to use a piece of his underpants as a bandage. But he's wearing none. I now look at him closely. He is the fair-headed boy of a little while ago. In the meantime, Cat has taken a bandage from a dead man's pocket, and we carefully bind the wound. I say to the youngster, who looks at us fixedly, "We're going for a stretcher now." Then he opens his mouth and whispers, "Stay here." "We'll be back again soon," says Cat. "We're only going to get a stretcher for you." We don't know if he understands. He whimpers like a child and plucks at us. "Don't go away." Cat looks around and whispers, "Shouldn't we just take a revolver and put an end to it?" The youngster will hardly survive the carrying, and at the most he will only last a few days. What he has gone through so far is nothing to what he's in for till he dies. Now he is numb and feels nothing. In an hour he will become one screaming bundle of intolerable pain. Every day that he lives will be a howling torture. And to whom does it matter whether he has them or not? I nod. "Yes, Cat, we ought to put him out of his misery." He stands still a moment. He has made up his mind. We look round, but we are no longer alone. A little group is gathering. From the shell holes and trenches appear heads. We get a stretcher. Cat shakes his head. "Such a kid." He repeats it. "Young innocence." Our losses are less than was to be expected. 5 killed and 8 wounded. It was, in fact, quite a short bombardment. 2 of our dead lie in the upturned graves. We merely throw the earth in on them. We go back. We trot off silently in single file, one behind the other. The wounded are taken to the dressing station. The morning is cloudy. The bearers make a fuss about numbers and tickets. The wounded whimper. It begins to rain. An hour later, we reach our lorries and climb in. There is more room now than there was. The rain becomes heavier. We take out waterproof sheets and spread them over our heads. The rain rattles down and flows off at the sides in streams. The lorries bump through the holes, and we rock to and fro in a half-sleep. 2 men in the front of the lorry have long forked poles. They watch for telephone wires which hang crosswise over the road so low that they might easily pull our heads off. The 2 fellows take them at the right moment on their poles and lift them over behind us. We hear their call, "Mind, wire!" Dip the knee in a half-sleep and straighten up again. Monotonously the lorries sway, monotonously come the calls, monotonously falls the rain. It falls on our heads, and on the heads of the dead up in the line, on the body of the little recruit with the wound that is so much too big for his hip. It falls on Kemmerich's grave, it falls in our hearts. An explosion sounds somewhere. We wince, our eyes become tense, our hands are ready to vault over the side of the lorry into the ditch by the road. Nothing happens. Only the monotonous cry, "Mind, wire!" Our knees bend. We are again half asleep. Chapter 5. Killing each separate louse is a tedious business when a man has hundreds. The little beasts are hard, and the everlasting cracking with one's fingernails very soon becomes wearisome. So Tjaden has rigged up the lid of a boot-polish tin with a piece of wire over the lighted stump of a candle. The lice are simply thrown into this little pan. Crack, and they're done for. We sit around with our shirts on our knees, our bodies naked to the warm air, and our hands at work. Haya has a particularly fine brand of louse. They have a red cross on their heads. He suggests that he brought them back from the hospital at Tourou, where they attended personally on a surgeon general. He says he means to use the fat that slowly accumulates in the tin lid for polishing his boots, and roars with laughter for half an hour at his own joke. But he gets little response today. We are too preoccupied with another affair. The rumor has materialized. Himmelstoss has come. He appeared yesterday. We've already heard the well-known voice. He seems to have overdone it with a couple of young recruits on the plowed field at home, and unknown to him, the son of the local magistrate was watching. That cooked his goose. He will get some surprises here. Chadden has been meditating for hours what to say to him. Hayer gazes thoughtfully at his great paws and winks at me. The thrashing was the high water mark of his life. He tells me he often dreams of it. Kropp and Müller are amusing themselves. From somewhere or other, probably the pioneer cookhouse, Kropp has bagged for himself a mess tin full of beans. Müller squints hungrily into it, but checks himself and says, "Albert, what would you do if it were suddenly peacetime again?" "There won't be any peacetime," says Albert, bluntly. "Well, but if," persists Müller, "what would you do?" "Clear out of this," growls Kropp. "Of course, and then what?" "Get drunk," says Albert. "Don't talk rot, I mean seriously." "So do I," says Kropp. "What else should a man do?" Cat becomes interested. He levies tribute on Kropp's tin of beans, swallows some, then considers for a while and says, "You might get drunk first, of course, but then you'd take the next train for home and mother. Peacetime, man." "Albert," he fumbles in his oilcloth pocketbook for a photograph and suddenly shows it all around, "my old woman." Then he puts it back and swears, "Damned lousy war." "It's all very well for you to talk," I tell him. "You've a wife and children." "True," he nods, "and I have to see to it that they have something to eat." We laugh. "They won't lack for that, Cat. You'd scrounge it from somewhere." Müller is insatiable and gives himself no peace. He wakes Haya Vestus out of his dream. "Haya, what would you do if it was peacetime?" "Give you a kick in the backside for the way you talk," I say. "How does it come about exactly?" "How does the cow shit come on the roof?" retorts Müller laconically, and turns to Haya Vestus again. It is too much for Haya. He shakes his freckled head. "You mean when the war is over?" "Exactly, you said it." "Well, there'd be women, of course, huh?" Haya licks his lips. "Sure." "By Jove, yes," says Haya, his face melting. "Then I'd grab some good buxom dame, some real kitchen wench with plenty to get hold of, you know, and jump straight into bed. Just you think, boys, a real feather bed with a spring mattress? I wouldn't put trousers on again for a week." Everyone is silent. The picture is too good. Our flesh creeps. At last Müller pulls himself together and says, "And then what?" A pause. Then Haya explains, rather awkwardly, "If I were a non-com, I'd stay with the Prussians and serve out my time." "Haya, you got a screw loose, surely," I say. "Have you ever dug peat?" he retorts good-naturedly. "You try it." Then he pulls a spoon out of the top of his boot and reaches over into Kropp's mess tin. "It can't be worse than digging trenches," I ventured. Haya chews and grins. "It lasts longer, though, and there's no getting out of it either." "But, man, surely it's better at home." "Some ways," says he, and with open mouth sinks into a daydream. You can see what he is thinking. There is the mean little hut on the moors, the hard work on the heath from morning till night in the heat, the miserable pay, the dirty laborers' clothes. "In the army in peacetime you've nothing to trouble about," he goes on. "Your food's found every day, or else you kick up a row. You've a bed every week, clean underwear like a perfect gent. You do your non-com's duty, you have a good suit of clothes. In the evening you're a free man and go off to the pub." Haya is extraordinarily set on his idea. He's in love with it. "And when your 12 years are up, you get your pension and become the village bobby, and you can walk about the whole day." He's already sweating on it. "And just you think how you'd be treated. Here a dram, there a pint. Everybody wants to be well in with a bobby." "You'll never be a non-com, though, Haya," interrupts Cat. Haya looks at him sadly and is silent. His thoughts still linger over the clear evenings in autumn, the Sundays in the heather, the village bells, the afternoons and evenings with the servant girls, the fried bacon and barley, the carefree hours in the alehouse. He can't part with all these dreams so abruptly. He merely growls, "What silly questions you do ask." He pulls his shirt over his head and buttons up his tunic.
"What would you do, Chadden?" asks Krupp.
Chadden thinks of one thing only.
"See to it that Himmelstoss didn't get past me."
Apparently he would like most to have him in a cage and sail into him with a club every morning. To Krupp, he says warmly,
"If I were in your place, I'd see to it that I became a lieutenant. Then you could grind him till the water in his backside boils."
"And you, Datering?"
asks Müller, like an inquisitor. He's a born schoolmaster with all his questions. Datering is sparing with his words, but on this subject he speaks. He looks at the sky and says only the one sentence, "I would go straight on with the harvesting." Then he gets up and walks off. He is worried. His wife has to look after the farm. They've already taken away two more of his horses. Every day he reads the papers that come to see whether it is raining in his little corner of Oldenburg. They haven't brought in the hay yet. At this moment Himmelstoss appears. He comes straight up to our group. Chadden's face turns red. He stretches his length on the grass and shuts his eyes in excitement. Himmelstoss is a little hesitant. His gait becomes slower. Then he marches up to us. No one makes any motion to stand up. Krupp looks up at him with interest. He continues to stand in front of us and wait. As no one says anything, he launches a,
"Well."
A couple of seconds go by. Apparently Himmelstoss doesn't quite know what to do. He would like most to set us all on the run again, but he seems to have learned already that the front line isn't a parade ground. He tries it on, though, and by addressing himself to one instead of to all of us, hopes to get some response. Krupp is nearest, so he favors
him. "Well, you here
too?" But Albert's no friend of
his. "A bit longer than you, I fancy,"
he retorts. The red moustache twitches.
"You don't recognize me anymore, what?"
Chadden now opens his eyes.
"I do, though."
Himmelstoss turns to him.
"Chadden, isn't it?"
Chadden lifts his head. "And do you know what you are?" Himmelstoss is disconcerted.
"Since when have we become so familiar? I don't remember that we ever slept in the gutter together."
He has no idea what to make of the situation. He didn't expect this open hostility. But he is on his guard. He has already had some rot dinned into him about getting a shot in the back. The question about the gutter makes Chadden so mad that he becomes almost witty.
"Now you've slept there by yourself."
Himmelstoss begins to boil, but Chadden gets in ahead of him. He must bring off his insult.
"Wouldn't you like to know what you are? A dirty hound, that's what you are. I've been wanting to tell you that for a long time."
The satisfaction of months shines in his dull pig's eyes as he spits out, "Dirty hound!" Himmelstoss lets fly too now.
"What's that, you muckrake, you dirty peat-stealer? Stand up there, bring your heels together when your superior officer speaks to you."
Chadden waves him off. "You take a run and jump at yourself, Himmelstoss." Himmelstoss is a raging book of army regulations. The Kaiser couldn't be more insulted.
"Chadden, I command you as your superior officer. Stand up!"
"Anything else you would like?" asks Chadden.
"Will you obey my order or not?"
Chadden replies, without knowing it, in the well-known classical phrase. At the same time, he ventilates his backside.
"I'll have you court-martialed!"
storms Himmelstoss. We watch him disappear in the direction of the orderly room. Haya and Chadden burst into a regular peat digger's bellow. Haya laughs so much that he dislocates his jaw and suddenly stands there helpless with his mouth wide open. Albert has to put it back again by giving it a blow with his fist. Cat is troubled. If he reports you, it'll be pretty serious.
Do you think he will?
Asks Chiadin.
Sure to, I say.
The least you'll get will be 5 days close arrest, says Cat.
That doesn't worry Chiadin. 5 days clink or 5 days rest.
And if they send you to the fortress? Urges the thoroughgoing Müller.
Well, for the time being, the war will be over, so far as I'm concerned.
Chiadin is a cheerful soul. There aren't any worries for him. He goes off with Haya and Lear so that they won't find him in the first flush of excitement.
Müller hasn't finished yet. He tackles Krop again.
Albert, if you were really at home now, what would you do?
Krop is contented now and more accommodating.
How many of us were there in the class, exactly?
We count up. Out of 20, 7 are dead, 4 wounded, 1 in a madhouse. That makes 12.
3 of them are lieutenants, says Müller.
Do you think they would still let Cantorex sit on them?
We guess not. We wouldn't let ourselves be sat on, for that matter.
What do you mean by the threefold theme in William Tell? Says Krop reminiscently and roars with laughter.
What was the purpose of the Poetic League of Göttingen? Asked Müller suddenly and earnestly.
How many children has Charles the Bald? I interrupt gently.
You'll never make anything of your life, Boimer, croaks Müller.
When was the Battle of Zana? Krop wants to know.
You lack the studious mind, Krop. Sit down, 3 minus, I say.
What offices did Lycurgus consider the most important for the state? Asks Müller, pretending to take off his pince-nez.
Does it go, we Germans fear God and none else in the whole world, or we the Germans fear God and...
I submit.
How many inhabitants has Melbourne? Asks Müller.
How do you expect to succeed in life if you don't know that?
I ask Albert hotly, which he caps with, what is meant by cohesion?
We remember mighty little of all that rubbish. Anyway, it has never been the slightest use to us. At school, nobody ever taught us how to light a cigarette in a storm of rain, nor how a fire could be made with wet wood, nor that it is best to stick a bayonet in the belly, because there it doesn't get jammed as it does in the ribs.
Müller says thoughtfully, what's the use?
We'll have to go back and sit on the forms again.
I consider that out of the question. We might take a special exam.
That needs preparation.
And if you do get through, what then? A student's life isn't any better. If you have no money, you have to work like the devil.
It's a bit better. But it's rot all the same, everything they teach you.
Krop supports me.
How can a man take all that stuff seriously when he's once been out here?
Still, you must have an occupation of some sort, insists Müller, as though he were Cantorex himself.
Albert cleans his nails with a knife. We are surprised at this delicacy, but it is merely pensiveness. He puts the knife away and continues.
That's just it. Cat and Dietering and Haya will go back to their jobs because they had them already. Himmelstoss, too. But we never had any. How will we ever get used to one after this, here?
He makes a gesture toward the front.
What we'll want is a private income, and we'll be able to live by ourselves in a wood. I say, but at once feel ashamed of this absurd idea.
But what will really happen when we go back, wonders Müller, and even he is troubled.
Krop gives a shrug.
I don't know. Let's get back first, then we'll find out.
We are all utterly at a loss.
What could we do? I ask.
I don't want to do anything, replies Krop wearily.
You'll be dead one day, so what does it matter?
I don't think we'll ever go back.
When I think about it, Albert, I say after a while, rolling over on my back, when I hear the word peacetime, it goes to my head. And if it really came, I think I would do some unimaginable thing, something, you know, that it's worth having lain here in the muck for. But I can't even imagine anything. All I do know is that this business about professions and studies and salaries and so on, it makes me sick. It is and always was disgusting. I don't see anything at all, Albert. All at once everything seems to me confused and hopeless. Krupp feels it too. It will go pretty hard with us all. But nobody at home seems to worry much about it. 2 years of shells and bombs. A man won't peel that off as easy as a sock. We agree that it's the same for everyone, not only for us here, but everywhere. For everyone who is of our age, to some more, and to others less. It is the common fate of our generation. Albert expresses it. The war has ruined us for everything. He is right. We are not youth any longer. We don't want to take the world by storm. We are fleeing. We fly from ourselves, from our life. We were 18 and had begun to love life and the world, and we had to shoot it to pieces. The first bomb, the first explosion, burst in our hearts. We are cut off from activity, from striving, from progress. We believe in such things no longer. We believe in the war. The orderly room shows signs of life. Himmelstoss seems to have stirred them up. At the head of the column trots the fat sergeant major. It is queer that almost all of the regular sergeant majors are fat. Himmelstoss follows him, thirsting for vengeance. His boots gleam in the sun. We get up. "Where's Jaden?" the sergeant puffs. No one knows, of course. Himmelstoss glowers at us wrathfully. "You know very well. You won't say that's the fact of the matter. Out with it." Fatty looks round inquiringly, but Jaden is not to be seen. He tries another way. "Jaden will report at the orderly room in 10 minutes. Then he steams off with Himmelstoss in his wake. I have a feeling that next time we go up wiring, I'll be letting a bundle of wire fall on Himmelstoss's leg, hints Krupp. We'll have quite a lot of jokes with him, laughs Müller. That is our sole ambition, to knock the conceit out of a postman. I go into the hut and put Tjaden wise. He disappears. Then we change our posse and lie down again to play cards. We know how to do that, to play cards, to swear, and to fight. Not much for 20 years, and yet too much for 20 years. Half an hour later, Himmelstoss is back again. Nobody pays any attention to him. He asks for Tjaden. We shrug our shoulders. "Then you'd better find him," he persists. "Haven't you been to look for him?" Krupp lies back on the grass and says, "Have you ever been out here before?" "That's none of your business," retorts Himmelstoss. "I expect an answer." "Very good," says Krupp, getting up. "See up there where those little white clouds are? Those are anti-aircraft. We were over there yesterday, 5 dead and 8 wounded. And that's a mere nothing. Next time, when you go up with us, before they die, the fellows will come up to you, click their heels, and ask stiffly, 'Please, may I go? Please, may I hop it? We've been waiting here a long time for someone like you.'" He sits down again, and Himmelstoss disappears like a comet.
3 days CB, conjectures Cat.
"Next time I'll let fly," I say to Albert. But that is the end. The case comes up for trial in the evening. In the orderly room sits our lieutenant, Bertink, and calls us in, one after another. I have to appear as a witness and explain the reason of Tjaden's insubordination. The story of the bedwetting makes an impression. Himmelstoss is recalled, and I repeat my statement. "Is that right?" Bertink asks Himmelstoss. He tries to evade the question, but in the end has to confess, for Krupp tells the same story. "Why didn't someone report the matter then?" asks Bertink. We are silent. He must know himself how much use it is in reporting such things. It isn't usual to make complaints in the army. He understands it all right, though, and lectures Himmelstoss, making it plain to him that the front isn't a parade ground. Then comes Chardin's turn. He gets a long sermon and 3 days' open arrest. Bertink gives Krupp a wink and 1 day's open arrest. "It can't be helped," he says to him regretfully. He is a decent fellow. Open arrest is quite pleasant. The Clink was once a foul house. There we can visit the prisoners. We know how to manage it. Close arrest would have meant the cellar. They used to tie us to a tree, but that is forbidden now. In many ways, we are treated quite like men. An hour later, after Tjaden and Krop are settled in behind their wire netting, we make our way into them. Tjaden greets us crowing. Then we play scat far into the night. Tjaden wins, of course, the lucky wretch. When we break it up, Kat says to me, "What do you say to some roast goose?" "Not bad," I agree. We climb up on a munition wagon. The ride costs us 2 cigarettes. Kat has marked the spot exactly. The shed belongs to a regimental headquarters. I agree to get the goose and receive my instructions. The outhouse is behind the wall, and the door shuts with just a peg. Kat hoists me up. I rest my foot in his hands and climb over the wall. Kat keeps watch below. I wait a few moments to accustom my eyes to the darkness. Then I recognize the shed. Softly I steal across, lift the peg, pull it out, and open the door. I distinguish 2 white patches. 2 geese. That's bad. If I grab one, the other will cackle. Well, both of them. If I'm quick, it can be done. I make a jump. I catch hold of one, and the next instant, the second. Like a madman, I bash their heads against the wall to stun them, but I haven't quite enough weight. The beasts cackle and strike out with their feet and wings. I fight desperately, but Lord, what a kick a goose has! They struggle, and I stagger about. In the dark, these white patches are terrifying. My arms have grown wings, and I'm almost afraid of going up into the sky, as though I held a couple of captive balloons in my fists. Then the row begins. One of them gets his breath and goes off like an alarm clock. Before I can do anything, something comes in from outside. I feel a blow, lie outstretched on the floor, and hear awful growls. A dog. I steal a glance to the side. He makes a snap at my throat. I lie still and tuck my chin into my collar. It's a bulldog. After an eternity, he withdraws his head and sits down beside me. But if I make the least movement, he growls. I consider. The only thing to do is to get hold of my small revolver, and that, too, before anyone arrives. Inch by inch, I move my hand toward it. I have the feeling that it lasts an hour. The slightest movement, and then an awful growl. I lie still, then try again. When at last I have the revolver, my hand starts to tremble. I press it against the ground and say over to myself, jerk the revolver up, fire before he has a chance to grab, and then jump up. Slowly I take a deep breath and become calmer. Then I hold my breath, whip up the revolver, it cracks. The dog leaps howling to one side. I make for the door of the shed and fall head over heels over one of the scuttering geese. At full speed, I seize it again and with a swing toss it over the wall and clamber up. No sooner am I on top than the dog is up again, as lively as ever, and springs at me. Quickly I let myself drop. 10 paces away stands Cat with the goose under his arm. As soon as he sees me, we run. At last we can take a breather. The goose is dead, Cat saw to that in a moment. We intend to roast it at once so that nobody will be any wiser. I fetch a dixie and wood from the hut, and we crawl into a small, deserted lean-to which we use for such purposes. The single window space is heavily curtained. There is a sort of hearth, an iron plate set on some bricks. We kindle a fire. Cat plucks and cleans the goose. We put the feathers carefully to one side. We intend to make 2 cushions out of them with the inscription, "Sleep soft under shell fire." The sound of the gunfire from the front penetrates into our refuge. The glow of the fire lights up our faces. Shadows dance on the wall. Sometimes a heavy crash, and the lean-to shivers. Aeroplane bombs. Once we hear a stifled cry, a hut must have been hit. Aeroplanes drone. The tack-tack of machine guns breaks out. But no light that could be observed shows from us. We sit opposite one another, Cat and I, 2 soldiers in shabby coats, cooking a goose in the middle of the night. We don't talk much, but I believe we have a more complete communion with one another than even lovers have. We are 2 men, two minute sparks of life. Outside is the night and the circle of death. We sit on the edge of it, crouching in danger. The grease strips from our hands. In our hearts we are close to one another. The hour is like the room, flecked over with the lights and shadows of our feelings cast by a quiet fire. What does he know of me, or I of him? Formerly we should not have had a single thought in common. Now we sit with a goose between us and feel in unison, are so intimate that we do not even speak. It takes a long time to roast a goose, even when it is young and fat. So we take turns. One bastes it while the other lies down and sleeps. A grand smell gradually fills the hut. The noises without increase in volume pass into my dream and yet linger in my memory. In a half sleep I watch Cat dip and raise the ladle. I love him. His shoulders, his angular, stooping figure. And at the same time I see behind him woods and stars, and a clear voice utters words that bring me peace. To me, a soldier in big boots, belt, and knapsack, taking the road that lies before him under the high heaven, quickly forgetting and seldom sorrowful, forever pressing on under the wide night sky. A little soldier and a clear voice, and if anyone were to caress him, he would hardly understand. This soldier with the big boots and the shut heart, who marches because he is wearing big boots and has forgotten all else but marching. Beyond the skyline is a country with flowers, lying so still that he would like to weep. There are sights there that he has not forgotten, because he never possessed them, perplexing yet lost to him. Are not his 20 summers there? Is my face wet? And where am I? Cat stands before me. His gigantic, stooping shadow falls upon me like home. He speaks gently. He smiles and goes back to the fire. Then he says, "It's done." "Yes, Cat." I stir myself. In the middle of the room shines the brown goose. We take out our collapsible forks and our pocket knives, and each cuts off a leg. With it we have army bread dipped in gravy. We eat slowly and with gusto. "How does it taste, Cat?"
"Good. And yours?"
"Good, Cat." We are brothers and press on one another the choicest pieces. Afterwards I smoke a cigarette and Cat a cigar. There is still a lot left. "How would it be, Cat, if we took a bit to Krop and Tjaden?"
"Sure,"
says he. We carve off a portion and wrap it up carefully in newspaper. The rest we thought of taking over to the hut. Cat laughs and simply says,
"Tjaden."
I agree, we will have to take it all. So we go off to the fowl house to waken them. But first we pack away the feathers. Krop and Tjaden take us for magicians. Then they get busy with their teeth. Tjaden holds a wing in his mouth with both hands like a mouth organ and gnaws. He drinks the gravy from the pot and smacks his lips. "May I never forget you." We go to our hut. Again there is the lofty sky with the stars and the oncoming dawn, and I pass beneath it, a soldier with big boots and a full belly, a little soldier in the early morning. But by my side, stooping and angular, goes Cat, my comrade. The outlines of the huts are upon us in the dawn, like a dark, deep sleep.